Pacifica Radio. This is Democracy Now!
There's now a global peace movement emerging that joins with the global justice movement as posing a countervailing power to the United States.
The alternatives to globalization are very much found in indigenous people's communities, but these alternatives are really very much threatened because of globalization.
People around the world are now very, very scared of the insecurity caused by globalization, but also by the prospect of war, and we need to change that.
Is another world possible? All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. troops shot and killed 15 Iraqi civilians last night in the town of Fallujah, about 30 miles west of Baghdad. This according to eyewitnesses. One witness told the Agence France-Presse that six of the dead were children and close to 50 were injured. Exact details of the killings are unclear. Witnesses told the AFP U.S. troops opened fire on a crowd of people carrying portraits of Saddam Hussein celebrating his 66th birthday. Colonel Arnold Bray of the 82nd Airborne Division says soldiers shot at the crowd after some of the demonstrators fired on a schoolhouse where U.S. troops were headquartered. Al Jazeera is quoting residents as saying the troops opened fire after someone threw a rock at the school. The Associated Press is reporting residents say people were protesting the U.S. occupation and that all of them were schoolboys between the ages of 5 and 20 years old. Some say they had come to ask the U.S. troops to leave their schoolhouse. Meanwhile, in Saddam Hussein's town of Tikrit, residents mark their overthrown leader's birthday in violation of a U.S. ban of all birthday celebrations for Saddam. The Guardian of London reports people held small protests against the U.S. all around Tikrit. On one street, U.S. troops with the 4th Infantry Division arrived with four armored personnel carriers, seven Humvees. Soldiers used a loudspeaker to threaten force against the demonstrators if they didn't leave. The troops then pushed the demonstrators and tore up the pictures of Saddam Hussein. Around 300 Iraqis handpicked by the United States accepted a U.S. invitation to start the process of forming an interim government. Delegates pledged to hold a new meeting within a month to form a transitional government. The delegates gave no other details. Half the delegates were Iraqi exiles. The Guardian of London reports U.S. officials refused to supply a list of those invited, apparently to disguise the poor attendance. Nor would U.S. or British officials say how they had worked out the invitation list. The Dawa Party and the Iraqi Communist Party were excluded. Those parties had the largest representation in Iraq before Saddam's Ba'ath Party imposed one-party rule. And there were no representatives from the powerful Shia clergy. The U.S. Army announced it will deploy up to 4,000 additional military police and infantrymen in Baghdad over the next 10 days. Major General Glenn Webster, the deputy commander of U.S. ground forces, said U.S. forces had detained more than 5,000 law-breaking Iraqis in two large holding facilities in Baghdad. Occupation forces have given residents curfew orders. They cannot be in the streets from 11 to 6. They have also ordered government employees to return to their jobs and instructed hospitals to stay open 24 hours a day. The curfew from 11 p.m. to 6 a.m. U.S. Central Command has confirmed that U.S. forces in Iraq signed a ceasefire with an Iranian terrorist organization on April 15th. The People's Mujahideen supported the Iranian revolution against the U.S.-backed Shah, but then broke off from the rebels that took power. The group killed several U.S. military personnel and civilian contractors in the 1970s and supported the takeover of the U.S. embassy in 1979 in Tehran. It also carried out dozens of bombings, which the New York Times says were aimed at Iranian government workers and the Iranian military, but that killed civilians. The State Department added the People's Mujahideen to its list of terrorist organizations in 1997. The group has some 10,000 members in Iraq and is led by a woman. Under the deal, U.S. forces agreed not to damage any of the group property in its camps in Iraq and not to commit any hostile act toward the Iranian opposition forces covered by the agreement. And the People's Mujahideen will be allowed to keep its weapons for now. In return, the group agreed not to fire or to commit hostile acts against U.S. forces, not to destroy private or government property, and to place its artillery and anti-aircraft guns in non-threatening positions. The New York Times reports the accord is apparently the first between the U.S. military and a group the State Department has designated as terrorist. The Times adds, as recently as last week, senior Pentagon officials described the group as a vicious entity that had served as a de facto security organization for the Iraqi government. Dozens of members of Congress are supporting the group as a bulwark against Iran. Workers at Ground Zero in New York are still cleaning up the after effects from earlier U.S. support for Mujahideen groups. Senior U.S. officials today confirmed that the U.S. has moved its Air Command Center from Saudi Arabia to Qatar. Rear Admiral David Nichols also told reporters that U.S. air operations at Prince Sultan Air Base will be shut down completely by the end of the summer. Osama bin Laden has cited the U.S. military's large presence in Saudi Arabia as one of his main reasons for waging jihad against the United States. Saudi Arabia is home to the two holiest sites in Islam, Mecca and Medina. Now, according to the New York Times, the U.S. will maintain four military bases in Iraq, home to the cities of Najaf and Karbala, which are sacred to Shiite Muslims. Meanwhile, the top U.S. military officer in Europe outlined plans for establishing an array of skeletal bases and training areas in Eastern Europe. That's according to the Washington Post. Marine General James Jones said the new arrangement would allow the U.S. to reduce its military presence in Western Europe, but still be capable of mounting operations quickly in the region. This is the Bush administration is developing an increasingly strained relationship with key European allies, including Germany and France. British Prime Minister Tony Blair has warned France and other critics of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq not to start a new Cold War with the United States. He said any attempt to create, quote, rival centers of power to compete with the U.S. would restore the disastrous divisions of the Cold War era. However, the leaders of France, Germany, Belgium, and Luxembourg concluded a mini-summit in Brussels today with a call for the establishment of a European Defense Command headquarters. The headquarters would coordinate a 60,000-strong EU rapid reaction force, which the European Union is planning to have up and running by May. The four leaders, who all oppose the U.S. invasion of Iraq, said their proposals would represent a new stage in the building of a common European defense policy. Tony Blair also told anti-war critics not to, quote, gloat or jump around gleefully because coalition forces have so far failed to unearth weapons of mass destruction, which were meant to justify the invasion. He said he remains confident the weapons will be found. Meanwhile, it's now believed more than a dozen 55-gallon drums found in northern Iraq might contain rocket fuel, not the dangerous chemicals first suspected after 2 days of tests. For days, the U.S. corporate media has speculated whether the drums will prove to be the smoking gun. Lieutenant Colonel Ted Martin told Judith Miller of the New York Times that one of the drums had tested positive for a nerve agent. But in an interview later, a U.S. weapons inspector told the New York Times the tests show no positive results after all. The U.S. Central Command said today Iraq's former oil minister has surrendered. Ammar Mohammed Rashid turned himself in Monday and is in coalition custody. Rashid is a former Iraqi army general known as the Missile Man. Before becoming the oil minister, he was Saddam Hussein's point man on weapons delivery systems. He was also a member of the Military Industrialization Organization, the group responsible for producing all of Iraq's most lethal weapons. Rashid was listed as number 47 on the coalition's list of the 55 most wanted officials. North Korea has offered to abandon its nuclear weapons program, stop missile exports, and readmit foreign inspectors in return for a U.S. pledge not to attack. The offer was announced last night by the Chinese Foreign Ministry. Secretary of State General Colin Powell said the U.S. is examining the proposals. Meanwhile, a conference on nuclear nonproliferation opened in Geneva yesterday. U.S. Assistant Secretary of the Bureau of Nonproliferation John Wolf immediately told a news conference that Iran has, quote, an alarming clandestine program to acquire nuclear technology. But disarmament experts said U.S. lack of commitment to nonproliferation is as damaging as the behavior of the proliferators. Prosecutors yesterday announced a $1.4 billion settlement with the U.S.'s largest investment firms. At firm after firm, brokers and analysts convinced investors to buy billions of dollars worth of stock in companies they knew were in trouble. Some investment houses received secret payments from companies when they gave a strong recommendation to buy stock in that company. The SEC accused three firms in particular of fraud: Citigroup, Salomon Smith Barney, Merrill Lynch, and Credit Suisse First Boston. The settlement bars Citigroup CEO Sanford Weill from even communicating with his firm's stock analysts without a lawyer present. Citigroup is Wall Street's biggest bank. Salomon Smith Barney and First Boston were accused of spinning. That's selling terrific stock offerings to senior executives who turned around and sold the shares for a guaranteed profit. Meanwhile, the New York Times reports many of Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge's former staff members now lobby Ridge on behalf of corporate clients that want contracts with his multi-million dollar agency. Lobbying disclosure forms filed in Congress show at least four of Ridge's senior deputies at the White House are now working as Homeland Security lobbyists. Federal regulators have rejected the first complaint under a new campaign finance law that lifts soft money contributions to candidates. The complaint said both parties set up organizations to continue collecting soft money despite the ban. The government is negotiating a possible settlement with soap maker Dial Corporation in the largest class action lawsuit for sexual harassment ever. The suit charges that 90 employees at Dial's Aurora plant west of Chicago were groped, called names, and forced to look at pornography. Leaders from Southeast Asia, including China's premier, are set to meet for an emergency SARS summit in Bangkok today. Mongolia, South Korea, and New Zealand have joined the list of countries where people have been infected with the virus. The World Health Organization believes Vietnam has effectively contained the spread of the virus, but fears the crisis is only getting worse in China. China today announced 9 new deaths and over 200 new cases. Meanwhile, thousands of villagers from the rural town of Changguang attacked and ransacked a vacant high school that residents believed was being set up to quarantine SARS patients. The local government denied that's what's being done, but villagers saw construction crews installing metal partitions and beds in the building. And today is Israel's annual Remembrance Day for 6 million Jews killed in the Holocaust. A memorial siren brought Israel to a standstill for 2 minutes. The central theme of the observances focused on the 60th anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, when groups of Jews armed with smuggled weapons and makeshift explosives attacked Nazi occupation forces and stormtroopers. The German forces responded by cutting off the starved ghetto's water supply and burning its crowded buildings to the ground. Meanwhile, Israeli helicopter and tank raids have killed 3 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Israel's Supreme Court yesterday threw out an attempt to bar the army's use of flechette shells against Palestinians. The weapons explode in the air and spread thousands of small metal darts over a wide area. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights and Physicians for Human Rights had argued that use of the shells in residential areas is against international law and asked the court to outlaw their use in the Gaza Strip. And Israel's ambassador to the U.S. called for regime change in Iran and Syria. Daniel Ayalon said toppling Saddam Hussein's government is not enough. He did not call for an invasion of Syria and Iran, but advocated isolating them diplomatically, imposing economic sanctions, and using, quote, psychological pressure.
Who brought the bomb wrapped up in business cards and stained with steak? Who hires a maid to wash his money? Who keeps politicians on the take? Who puts outspoken third worlders in jail just to shut them down? Lies vary from place to place, but the truth is still the same, even in this town. Money junkies all over the world trample us on their way to the bank. They run in every race. Indigo. Third worlders see it first. The dynamite, the dozers, the cancer, and the acid rains. The corporate caterpillars come into our backyards and turn the world to pocket change.
Priests of the Golden Bull by Buffy St. Marie here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. How does the Wall Street Journal cover its own? Wall Street firms to pay $1.4 billion to end inquiry. Article on the front page today, in a pact that could change the face of Wall Street, 10 of the nation's largest security firms agree to pay a record $1.4 billion to settle government charges involving abuse of investors during the stock market bubble of the late 1990s. The long-awaited settlement, which followed an intense investigation that brought together three national regulatory bodies and a dozen state securities authorities, centers on civil charges that the Wall Street firms routinely issued overly optimistic stock research to investors in order to curry favor with corporate clients and win their lucrative investment banking business. We're going to talk about globalization and war today with three people who are well known for traveling around the world discussing issues of corporate versus grassroots globalization. John Cavana is with us, who's director at the Institute for Policy Studies and vice president of the International Forum on Globalization Board. We're also joined by Victoria Talley-Karpuz, founder and executive director of the Philippines-based Indigenous Peoples International Center for Policy Research and Education, and also Martin Kaur, who is director of the Third World Network, which is based in Malaysia. They're here to advise the United Nations today, and it's a pleasure to have you with us. But I want to start off with this latest news about Wall Street. John Cavana, what is your take on it?
My take is that at a time when we've had the worst corporate scandal since the 30s over the past year, there is a desperate attempt on Wall Street to regain the public trust, to regain credibility. So on the one hand, this sounds like a large amount of money, $1.4 billion. It isn't that large an amount of money for these giant firms. Citigroup is the largest financial firm in the United States. But it shows how desperate they are to get people's trust back. People are not investing in the stock market anymore. What I will say about this agreement that is outrageous is none of the firms had to admit any wrongdoing. So it's not as though we've got a brave new world of corporate compliance and corporate good practices. I think instead this is simply an attempt, it's a rather cynical attempt to say to Americans, we fixed it. We found some wrongdoing, we fixed it. Invest in Wall Street again. And I don't think the public will buy it.
We're talking about some of the most powerful investment firms in this country, Citigroup, Solomon Smith Barney, Merrill Lynch, Credit Suisse, First Boston. How do these fit into the picture of corporate globalization? And what kind of effects does it have on people? I mean, are there real crimes being committed here?
Well, there were huge crimes being committed here. Here in the United States, over half of the public has money in the stock market through their pension funds or their mutual funds. These firms were actually giving fraudulent information to you and me to curry favor with firms that then gave them other investment banking business. It's about the worst possible breach of trust that you can imagine. And I think it is, the public understands this. They understand these, many of these firms are swindling them, are not telling them the truth. And so with this settlement, they're trying to say to you, we've learned the lessons. We have a government that can check us. The Securities and Exchange Commission is involved in this settlement. Your Attorney General here in New York, Elliot Spitzer. So it is a, It's a real attempt just to say things are okay now by some of the world's largest financial firms.
Largest financial firms. Martin Kaur, you have long focused on the World Trade Organization. In September in Cancun, there will be another meeting of the WPO that people around the world are organizing around. How does this story fit into the World Trade Organization? And for listeners and viewers right now who aren't familiar with what it is, have just come to hear WTO, but forgot how it got started, maybe you can give us a little background.
Well, part of the WTO is a negotiation on services, you know, and financial services is part of it. So the developing countries are coming under great pressure to open up their financial markets to American, to European, to Japanese financial institutions so that they can come in and, you know, do business and take over the financial markets in many developing countries. The reports that we have read today confirm that the developing countries might become vulnerable to malpractices such as this, which will rip off the investors and consumers in developing countries. If in the United States, where, you know, there is a greater regulation, knowledge, awareness, and so on, this kind of thing can happen, then you can imagine how vulnerable the poorer countries are if these firms are allowed to come in and do the same kind of speculation, the same kind of misinformation, and so on. We have already suffered in 1997 to 98 a major financial crisis in Asia that was mainly caused or initiated by speculation over our currencies. And we certainly cannot afford to have a new bout of financial speculative or misinformation activities.
How are you organizing against the World Trade Organization in Cancun?
Well, the WTO negotiations are going on now in Geneva in many areas such as agriculture, intellectual property, and discussions are going on to expand the power of the WTO into new areas such as investment and government procurement. I think around the world, people are getting more and more information and they are extremely worried about the effects of the existing agreements in the WTO already. For example, the high prices of medicines that is caused by the intellectual property agreement in WTO, the millions of farmers, small farmers in many developing countries that are now receiving cheap imports coming from the United States and Europe. Cheap because they have been artificially subsidized and therefore the cost has gone down, but overwhelming the more efficient farmers in developing countries. This is already becoming a major catastrophe. And at the same time, there is a movement by the United States, but also by Europe, to lower the tariffs for industrial products in developing countries. Now, if that happens, then many domestic firms in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, will have to close down and many thousands of people will be thrown out of a job just so that cheap imports can come in. So we are now seeing in the last few months a very intense program of negotiations that may lead to even more economic chaos in developing countries. Many groups have now been set up all over the world to monitor what is happening, and these groups are now talking to their governments to try to prevent further deterioration of the situation. And many of these groups are now coming to Cancun so that they can make their voices heard on what kind of world trading system we don't want and what kind of system we want in the future.
Victoria Tolly Corpus. You're director of the Philippines-based Indigenous Peoples International Center for Policy Research. I wanted to ask you how war fits into the issue of globalization. Latest news we have out of the Philippines, U.S. and Philippine troops together will storm and secure urban buildings, treat the sick, and practice crisis management while building cooperation during the 2003 Balikatan training exercise starting Friday. The two-week exercise is one of dozen or so annual joint exercises between the United States and the Philippines, also bears a resemblance in name only to a contentious operation planned for later this year. It's Tagalog for shoulder to shoulder, or shouldering the load together. Its cousin, Balikatan 031, a longer-term counterterrorism operation expected to start later this year in the southern Philippines. The U.S. is re-entering the Philippines after U.S. military bases were shut down there. Can you comment on this?
Well, that's really a very unfortunate development, because Filipino peoples really struggled very hard to get the bases out. And now, under the pretext of containing terrorism, now the U.S. troops are again entering into our country, even if many of the senators and congressmen themselves said that it's against the Constitution, because we have a provision in our Constitution which does not allow foreign troops operating in our country. So it's really a very serious development insofar as, of course, the sovereignty of the country is concerned, and also insofar as human rights violations against the Filipino peoples are concerned.
And how does war fit together with globalization?
Well, presently, of course, the war efforts, supposed to be counterterrorism efforts in the Philippines, are really there to contain the protests of many communities against the destruction of their lands, against the appropriation of their lands, because of all these efforts to facilitate the appropriation of these lands through the rules, for instance, of the WTO, and also through the conditionalities imposed by the World Bank and the IMF. So this is really a situation where the control of peoples over their resources and over their territories is very much undermined because of globalization and the resistance that the people are giving, are offering to these kinds of moves is now considered, terrorist, and it justifies the entry of military forces into the communities. And now even the U.S. forces are being brought in to help contain those kinds of protests and resistance.
You've also been involved with the whole issue of the Human Genome Project. Can you talk about where that stands right now?
Well, presently, there are still all these efforts by pharmaceutical corporations and even by universities to gather genetic materials from indigenous peoples. It is still seen as, the genetic materials of indigenous peoples are considered as potential sources of, additional profits for these biotechnology corporations. So all over the world, it's still a continuing activity, in spite of the fact that indigenous peoples have come up very strongly to say there should be a moratorium on this kind of activity.
And explain what it is.
Well, this Human Genome Diversity Project was a project that was launched by this Human Genome Organization to collect genetic materials from indigenous peoples, because they claim that indigenous peoples have pure, their genetic materials are not adulterated, because we stay in isolated communities. We haven't really intermarried with the dominant populations, so our genetic materials can offer a lot of potential in terms of discovering a medicine, potential genetic therapy methods, and also possible sources of medicines that can be developed in the future.
How are people specifically organizing around it, and where is it based?
Well, this Human Genome Organization and also the pharmaceuticals are based mainly here in the U.S., of course, and in Europe, also in Japan. And they are organizing this through say even universities, they give some funds to the universities to gather these materials. It's very easy because you just get swabs from the mucous membrane or even hair, the hair roots and the skin, you know. And so it's so easy to gather it. And they make use of universities and even medical schools and also the departments of health under the pretext of, say, collecting blood, you know, blood sampling and all that. So it's a very easy process, and yet the implications are really very serious.
Are there any more examples of whole lineages of people being patented, for example, by the U.S. government?
Well, the examples that we have are still the ones that they have done in Panama when they patented the Guaymi people, and then also in Solomon Islands and in Papua New Guinea. So those are still the examples that we have up to now. But we don't really know anymore because, you know, you cannot keep track of the extensiveness of what they're doing, and we just don't have the possibility to keep track of this. Hmm.
John Cavanna, the whole group of the International Forum on Globalization has produced a new book, Alternatives to Economic Globalization, A Better World Is Possible. Can you talk about the premise of the book and then some of the research you have done for it?
Sure. Well, the premise of the book is that corporate globalization has desperately failed the environment, people, equality all around the world now for decades, and that millions of people have come together to organize against it. And the first question we're always asked, especially by skeptical mainstream media people, is, yeah, but you don't know what you're for. So we got together in the International Forum on Globalization. We got 24 of the best people from North and South, and we spent 3 years laying out what we're for. And it turns out we have a lot of ideas. And what the book does is it lays out 10 principles, starting with democracy and ecological sustainability, that would be counter principles for building sustainable societies and different rules and institutions. And then we lay out, we were just talking about corporations earlier, we lay out the case for changing the rules and incentives around corporations so that economic activity would be more locally based, more democratic, more accountable. And we lay out alternatives for these horrible institutions that Martin just described, the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund. And one point I just want to say, where this in some ways comes together with the peace movement, is we do believe that these giant institutions that are dominated by corporations and by the United States must be dismantled and replaced with new entities that would be under the United Nations, which has more democratic potential, where you need a global trade body, you need a global finance organization, just as right now I would say one of the central tasks of the peace movement is saying we do not accept the United States saying it will create ad hoc coalitions of the coerced, as we call it, they call it coalitions of the willing, as a replacement to the United Nations. The United Nations should be taking the lead on inspections for weapons of mass destruction around the world, just as it could be taking the lead to put for a new entity in the UN to put checks and balances on corporations.
Mm-hmm. The monetary system that we operate on today, Martin Kaur, from Bretton Woods to now, a lot of young people who listen to this don't even know what Bretton Woods is, a forest somewhere. can you talk about how we came to be where we are?
Well, the Bretton Woods is somewhere in the United States. I'm not really sure where, but
New Hampshire. In the hills of New Hampshire.
It was a historic meeting, and at that meeting, the economic experts of the world came together, and they made very interesting decisions that, number one, in the area of trade, countries should try to trade with one another and not try to put too many barriers. You must remember that most of the countries present were the developed countries at the same stage of development. So free trade amongst them would be beneficial, largely beneficial. If Europe trades with the United States and they don't put barriers and so on, then there might be prosperity because these are countries at the same stage of development. But at the same time, it was recognized by eminent economists such as Keynes in the United Kingdom that finance is a different kettle of fish, because if money flows across borders too easily without controls and regulations, then we might end up with financial speculation that will cause such economic instability that it would disrupt production, jobs and trade. So what they did in Bretton Woods was really to limit the speculation that could be done with finance by imposing a fixed exchange rate system around the world and strict capital controls in each country to prevent the outflow of capital that was not related to real economic activity. Now, this went on until around 1972, when the system of fixed exchange rates collapsed. And from 1972 onwards, each government in the developed countries, in the developed world, relaxed their rules on financial regulation and controls and increasingly allowed the free flow of money across borders until we have the situation today where money is flowing very freely across borders at the rate of more than $1 trillion a day, 98% of which is mainly for speculative or investment activity not related to trade and production. This is now spread to the poor developing countries that really do not have the means, the capacity, or the ability to regulate finance in a proper way. Even in countries like the United States, you have financial scandals. But in the developing countries, they are really subjected to the tidal waves of inflows and outflow of funds, to the activities of hedge funds that are speculating on the levels of currency and stock market, and that can totally disrupt economies that are otherwise doing very well in terms of production, in terms of trade, and so on. So what we now need is a review of this whole historical experience and go back to the period of Bretton Woods, in which we can get production and trade going in the best possible way, in ways that do not disrupt especially the poor economies. But we also have to go back to the period of regulating capital flows so that finance and money serves the real needs of production and jobs and not disrupts that production of the real world.
How does war fuel the economy? How do some benefit from it and some get so overwhelmingly wounded by it?
Well, right now we have a U.S. economy where three sets of firms are benefiting greatly from this war. The oil companies, of course, the defense contractors, and the Bechtels and Halliburtons linked with the administration that are going to do the rebuilding. I will say this, though. I am quite struck by how many other large global corporations aren't helped by war and actually are... I think I've begun to glimpse some corporate people. They won't speak publicly, but I think they're privately, they're going to speak with their wallets. They are worried about the breakup of the alliance between U.S. and Europe. They are worried about the breakdown in a multilateral system that is important for trading and investment. And I think the Bush people are so extreme now on unilateral aggressive wars that even some large corporations are beginning to worry. And what you'll see is a split in the corporate community. Those that directly benefit, and of course those are many of the companies that are served by Bush's entourage. He comes out of the oil industry, Halliburton was Cheney's company. They are greatly served, others are not.
Victoria Tolikorpus in the Philippines now.
Well, our president said that after the war in Iraq, our economy will benefit because we will be able to send the overseas contract workers to help in the reconstruction of Iraq. But of course, that is a very cynical position because our position is that the country should itself develop its own capacity to be able to give jobs to our own people and not just rely on these kinds of developments to just send people to earn dollars abroad. You know, so that's the globalization, the impact of this war has really been very bad for the Philippines in terms of course the way that our whole rights to determine our own development is affected, but on the other hand, the present government says that it can help prop up the economy because we have countries where we can send our contract workers.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. You're headed over to the United Nations right now. What are you going to be doing there?
We are advising the United Nations. We are trying to spread the message that the United Nations is part of the solution, but we also are trying to advise the UN to be wary not to get sucked into any kind of legitimation of this illegal, aggressive war of the United States.
And then you'll be speaking in New York, and you've put out Alternatives to Economic Globalization. Interesting to talk to you today on the morning of a massive day of protest in New York as people link the issue of the economy at home with the war abroad. It is a protest that is sponsored by United for Peace and Justice. Thank you all for being with us. John Cavana is with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Victoria Tolly Corpus is founder and executive director of the Philippines-based Indigenous Peoples International Center for Policy Research and Education. And Martin Kaur, also with the International Forum on Globalization. And the website?
It's www.ifg.org.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, back in a minute.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell, and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware. Who's dying for your freedom in this land? Pays the cost for the liberties you demand.
Sarah Thompson, Is It for Freedom? You're listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. Our website is democracynow.org. Teach-ins continue around the country. This past week at New York University, David Palumbo Leo joined a number of people talking about the issue of who's next, North Korea and beyond. He was speaking at NYU Law School. He is a professor of comparative literature and director of the program in modern thought and literature at Stanford University. Taking on the issue of preemption and the future of Asia-Pacific America. This is Professor David Palumbo Leo.
The events of September 11th provided a near-perfect pretext for a war on Iraq. What were its specific effects, and what is the connection between these effects and the Middle East? The effects of 9/11 for Asia included the reterritorialization of Asia-Pacific as a region, the remapping of Asia-Pacific as a correlate territory for global terrorism occurred immediately. Republican Congressman Sam Brownback of Kansas announced, quote, "It appears the Philippines is going to be the next target after Afghanistan in the war on terrorism." The U.S. created a second front by sending 1,200 troops to the Philippines in January 2002. This redefinition of the region prompted new relations between Asia-Pacific countries and the U.S., amongst themselves and within their own national borders. Several key Asian countries renegotiated for increased U.S. and foreign aid, both to fight terrorism but also to prop up national and regional economies and political power bases, giving rise to a set of potentially contradictory demands serving various national, international, and regional interests. The Jakarta Post celebrated, saying, "Thanks to the war against terrorism, ASEAN, which lost its fire and fame due to the 97 economic crisis, has regained not only confidence but respect." So this is kind of reconsolidating effect of terrorism on the region. In November 2002, at least 19 countries took part in an anti-terrorism conference in Manila that was co-hosted by the World Tourism Organization. The conference was called International Conference on Terrorism and Tourist Recovery. The participants included all 10 ASEAN countries, plus the US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, South Korea, China, and the United Kingdom. So again, this widening web of new renegotiated relationships. Not only were regional relations revised, but international ones as well. For example, in November 2002, the European Commission said that Europe would help the Philippines boost its capabilities to fight terrorism through technical and funding assistance and renegotiate a formal dispute over high European tariffs in the Asia Pacific. It also offered European support for development aid to the Muslim-held southern Philippines region. In December, China's Public Security Minister, Jia Chunhuang, struck an agreement with Philippines Interior and Local Government Secretary Jose Lina Jr. for closer cooperation between their respective police forces. As far as Asia Pacific is concerned, beyond the new configurations of regional and national spaces, what's going on specifically with regard to U.S. strategic interests? Why all the attention to the Asia Pacific? And why was the U.S. so interested in the opening that Arroyo provided? We have to look back to the 90s, and I'll ask you to remember that this is when Wolfowitz's defense planning guidance was leaked to the press, and the United States' global preemptive hegemonic intentions were made clear. In 1991, Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad, author of the book The Asia That Can Say No, proposed establishment of an East Asia Economic Group, excluding the United States, and to be led by Japan. The specter of increased Japanese influence in the region, along with the expulsion of U.S. military bases from the Philippines, caused the U.S. to place increased pressure on Guam, Micronesia, and other islands to serve as strategic purposes. But what were these strategic purposes? According to the 1997 report on the Quadrennial Defense Review by the U.S. Department of Defense, U.S. national defense and security policy implemented by 100,000 U.S. troops deployed in the region is intertwined with economic globalization, which requires, quote, the protection of the sea lanes of trade and ensuring unhampered access to key market, energy supplies, and strategic resources. The Pacific was considered to contain, quote, the highways of trade which are vital to U.S. security. All this is drawn together in a RAND study conducted by the U.S. Air Force and completed in the fall of 2000. The study, entitled The U.S. and Asia Toward a New U.S. Strategy and Force Posture, was written by a group whose lead author is a critical figure in both our policies in the Asia Pacific and the Middle East, Zalmay Khalilzad. Khalilzad is a member of the Defense Policy Board. He is author as well as From Containment to Global Leadership and Bush's advisor on Afghanistan. He was instrumental in a series of conferences that produced an interim post-Taliban government in Afghanistan, and he has been named the U.S. envoy who will meet with Iraqi opposition leaders to form a government that will take power following the interim period of U.S. administration. The RAND study defines the strategic importance of Asia-Pacific in clear terms, and it's too bad that our map doesn't extend a little bit further west. The RAND study notes, quote, Southeast Asia lies at the intersection of two of the world's most heavily traveled sea lines of communication, or SLOCs. The east-west route connects the Indian and Pacific Oceans, while the north-south route links Australia and New Zealand and Northeast Asia. Nearly half the world's merchant fleet capacity sails through the SLOCs of the South China Sea and the waters surrounding Indonesia. These SLOCs serve as economic lifelines by which the economies of Northeast Asia receive oil and other critical imports and export finished goods to the rest of the world. Now, most germane for today's teach-in, the study goes on to note, from a military perspective, these sea lanes are critical to the movement of U.S. forces from the Pacific into the Indian Ocean and the Persian Gulf. For example, during the Iran-Iraq War, 75% of U.S. ships deployed to the Indian Ocean and the Gulf were 7th Fleet ships operating out of Subic Bay in the Philippines. During the first Gulf War, the base was a critical point for refueling and reprovisioning for the U.S. Navy. Now, this is crucial. The RAND study forwards a set of strategic possibilities for the region, and it goes from sort of one extreme to the other, but this is what it begins with. At one end of the spectrum would be a strategy built on ensuring and strengthening U.S. hegemony in Asia. The key to the strategy would lie in maintaining and increasing the U.S. position of preeminent power in the region. if necessary, taking steps to constrain the economic and military growth of any other country that could threaten that preeminence. And this is what Jonathan Schell was talking about. It goes on, such a strategy would require maximum vigilance as well as the expenditure of money and effort. And as such, would probably prove incompatible with U.S. domestic requirements. Okay, so this is something that they'd like to do, but it might be too costly politically. And then it lists a set of more moderate proposals ranging from forming a condominium with one of Asia's major powers to adopting a role of balancer among the major regional powers, the creation of a collective security system, and last, God forbid, disengagement from Asia. But note how 9/11 changed everything, and the Iraq War's success may encourage Washington to be more inclined to the other end of the spectrum. And note how this proposal follows closely the logic and goals of the defense planning guidance of that period, and how these themes are picked up and underscored a decade later in Bush's national security strategy manifested in the Iraq War. Now let me just take a couple of minutes to talk about the volatility of preemption in this strategic environment. The notion of preemptive action in the Pacific is not new. In the early 1980s, the United States, preparing to fight a Soviet fleet, strategized an air and naval attack on Vladivostok. It accepted the option of a limited nuclear war and a first strike option. Navy Secretary John Lehman said in June 84, quote, who gets to shoot first will have more to do with who wins than any other factor. Near the end of the Cold War, there was the suggestion that the U.S. reorient itself from deterring a vanishing Soviet threat to containing terrorist threats emanating from the Third World. This idea can be found, for example, in a 1988 document, Discriminate Deterrence, produced by the Presidential Commission on Long-Term Integrated Strategy. At that time as well, General Dynamics singled out India as one of the key targets for a next generation of cruise missiles. A 52-page briefing paper outlined a scenario for the year 2000 in which India and Pakistan are spoiling over a war for Kashmir. The U.S. would intervene to prevent an Indian nuclear strike against Pakistan and use 307 cruise missiles to neutralize targets in India. This is an internal document that General Dynamics invented. Today, the logic of preemption has been taken up in the Asia Pacific. A few months ago, Prime Minister of Australia, John Howard, issued a statement in which he said, it stands to reason that if you believe that somebody's going to launch an attack on your country, either of a conventional kind or a terrorist kind, and you have the capacity to stop it, and there was no alternative other than to use that capacity, then of course you would use it. In response, a spokesman for Indonesia's foreign ministry told ABC Radio that Australia did not have the right to launch military strikes in other countries and warned that countries could not flout international law and norms willy-nilly. The Thai government said no country should do anything like Howard suggested. Each country has its own sovereignty and must be protected. And Philippines' national security advisor said, it's a very surprising statement to say the least, in fact bordering on shocking. I can't believe that it would come from a supposedly friendly country in the neighborhood. You were talking about a region with a very strong government. This is the 21st century, not the 19th century. And Arroyo, when asked about Howard's comments, said, very Bush-like again, oh, I don't listen to what other people say. I mean, it was very unconscious, but very true. And then she followed up by saying, well, we all know that the yen is mightier than the sword. It shows ways of dealing with things like this. What we have then is a powerful combination of three things: unilateralism, preemption, and hegemonic initiatives, all with anti-terrorism as a spark. In sum, the future of Asia-Pacific is intimately tied to the future of the Middle East, both because of its strategic importance via the South China Sea, but also because of the ideological aftereffects of 9/11 and the Iraq War on reshaping national, regional, and international policies. Finally, let me say a few things about Asian America. First, the interstitial space between the U.S. and Asia Pacific has been deeply affected in the radical redefinition of relations. I'm speaking of immigrant and diasporic subjects. Renegotiations of regional and international relations provided the occasion for revisiting new anti-terrorist policies in Europe and the U.S. that adversely affected Filipinos, for example. In the anti-terrorism pro-tourism conference, Arroyo asked Francis Taylor, U.S. ambassador to the Philippines, for exemptions for Filipino-American security workers who would lose their jobs because of their lack of citizenship. And Colin Powell was also pressed on Asian American issues upon his announcement of the signing of the Mutual Logistics Support Agreement. He was tested on the question of U.S. deportation of overseas Filipino workers, as well as the loss of jobs faced by them. And the Philippines Foreign Undersecretary Delia Albert asked the European Union to remove the Philippines from a list of countries whose citizens have to undergo special screening before they're granted entry visas. So in the trafficking between the regions, there are very important negotiations based on this opportunity. Closer to home, let me just mention five things. I'll just do it as a list. First, the real sense of increased militarization. When Turkey refused our troops that space, it set the U.S. government on a rampage to build up more bases around the world so that little wrinkle could never be significant again. The significance of such a siphoning of economic and political resource capital into such an enterprise and the draining of them from social welfare to other types of domestic issues. Things that the RAND report worried about, but now I think those kinds of concerns are less striking. The racial composition of the U.S. all-volunteer army. I think that when we talk about an all-volunteer army, we have to understand the conditions in which this volunteerism takes place and the very uneven effects it has on different racial groups. Four, the possible resurgence of xenophobia and attacks on unpatriotic Americans, those who would be dissent. And five, the heightened surveillance on immigrant groups and dissidents. Wiretapping of trans-Pacific communications, especially at the university. You know, Jack mentioned how precious our universities are, and yet you know that under the Patriot Act, all of your transcripts are open for access, lest you be building a nuclear weapon. But anything that you have at the university is now available to the U.S. government, plus the visa hassles for international students, et cetera. Overall and in conclusion, note how the logic of preemption hijacks the future. I think this is a really important thing for us to think about. Our imagination is now pegged to a specific, pragmatic purpose of imagining who threatens us, who might threaten us, and how to neutralize that threat. How to neutralize it seems to require much less imagination than the others. But the whole issue of preemption masks the real issue for me, that is one of global dominance and strategic applications of preemption. We don't want to preempt everybody, but there are certain sites that we want to involve ourselves in. Obviously and critically, you cannot engage the logic of preemption without hegemony. But the whole notion of hegemony is now, you know, this wonderful phrase, benevolent hegemony, that was articulated by Crystal and Kagan in 96 when they proposed a neo-Reaganite foreign strategy. That was, if you read that 96 document, you get the flavor of a lot of what's happening now. Finally, as a literary critic, you wonder what a conflict professor is doing up here. I'm very interested in the power of rhetoric. I'm especially interested in the immense power of storytelling. You know, how do we buy certain stories as realistic and having a purchase on our imagination? Against the narrative and political plots of preemption, we need to forge critical counter-narratives, counter-imaginings, and for that we need information, knowledge, multiple perspectives, and hence my delight at being here and my anticipation of our question and answer. Thank you.
David Palumbo Leo, Professor of Comparative Literature, Director of the Program in Modern Thought and Literature at Stanford University. If you'd like to get a video or audio of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. That's democracynow.org. Our email address is mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Sharif Abdel-Kadous, Mike Burke, Noah Rival, Elizabeth Press, Anna Noguera. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Again, if you'd like to get a video, 1-800-881-2359. I'm Amy Goodman. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Yes, I'm from Nigeria, and it's good to talk about the election. A little bit of digression from Iraq after.
Well, today we will talk about Nigeria, the largest or most populous country in Africa. It's also the fifth largest supplier of oil to the United States. Then the battle of the environment breaks out as the Pentagon urges fewer limits on the military. Rules on marine mammals, toxic waste, and air quality are seen as an obstacle to training. We'll also take a look at what's happening to lettuce in California.
We conducted the first ever supermarket tests on to determine levels of toxic rocket fuel in lettuce that's grown in Southern California.
And we'll speak with Charlie Wolf Smoke, a Native American who denies U.S. or Canadian citizenship. He is set to be deported to the United States today after months of battling Canadian immigration authorities. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This is the War and Peace Report. U.S. troops shot and killed 15 Iraqi civilians last night in the town of Fallujah, about 30 miles west of Baghdad, according to eyewitnesses. One witness told the AFP six of the dead were children, close to 50 were injured. Exact details of the killings are unclear. According to the 82nd Airborne Division, soldiers said that they shot at the crowd after some of the demonstrators fired on the schoolhouse where U.S. troops were headquartered. Al Jazeera is quoting residents as saying the troops opened fire after someone threw a rock at the school. The Associated Press is reporting residents say people were protesting the U.S. occupation. All of them were schoolboys between the ages of 5 and 20 years old. Others said they simply wanted the U.S. troops out of their school. Meanwhile, in Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit, residents marked their overthrown leader's birthday yesterday in violation of a U.S. ban on all birthday celebrations for Saddam. The Guardian of London reports people held small protests against the U.S. all around the city. On one street, U.S. troops with the 4th Infantry Division arrived with four armored personnel carriers, seven Humvees. Soldiers used a loudspeaker to threaten force against the demonstrators if they didn't leave. The troops then pushed the demonstrators and tore up their pictures of Saddam. Around 300 Iraqis handpicked by the U.S. yesterday accepted a U.S. invitation to start the process of forming an interim government. Delegates pledged to hold a new meeting within a month to select a transitional government. Half the delegates were Iraqi exiles. The Guardian of London reports U.S. officials refused to supply a list of those invited, apparently to disguise the poor attendance. Nor would U.S. or British officials say how they'd worked out the invitation lists. The Dawa Party and the Iraqi Communist Party were excluded. Those parties had the largest representation in Iraq before Saddam's Ba'ath Party imposed one-party rule. And there were no representatives from the powerful Shia clergy. A huge explosion was heard in Baghdad today, and a massive plume of black smoke could be seen pouring into the sky. The blast came from the southeast of the city. At the time of the broadcast, no further details are possible or available. Meanwhile, the U.S. Army announced it'll deploy up to 4,000 additional military police and infantrymen in Baghdad over the next 10 days. The deputy commander of U.S. ground forces said U.S. forces have detained more than 5,000 law-breaking Iraqis in two large holding facilities in Baghdad, whose law he was referring to is not clear. Occupation forces have given residents curfew orders. They cannot be in the streets from 11 p.m. to 6 a.m. They've also ordered government employees to return to their jobs and instructed hospitals to stay open 24 hours a day. U.S. Central Command has confirmed U.S. forces in Iraq signed a ceasefire with an Iranian organization the State Department has classified as terrorist. They say the signing occurred on April 15th. The People's Mujahideen supported the Iranian revolution against the U.S.-backed Shah, but then broke off from the rebels when that took power. The group killed several U.S. military personnel and civilian contractors in the 70s and supported the takeover of the U.S. embassy in Tehran in 1979. It also carried out dozens of bombings, which the New York Times says were aimed at Iranian government workers and the Iranian military, but that killed civilians. The State Department added the People's Mujahideen to its list of terrorist organizations in 1997. The group has some 10,000 members in Iraq and is led by a woman. Under the deal, U.S. forces agreed not to damage any of the group property in its camps in Iraq and not to commit any hostile act toward the Iranian opposition forces covered by the agreement. And the People's Mujahideen will be allowed to keep its weapons for now. In return, the group agreed not to fire on or commit other hostile acts against U.S. forces, not to destroy private or government property, and to place its artillery and anti-aircraft guns in non-threatening positions. New York Times reports the accord is apparently the first between the U.S. military and a group the State Department has designated as terrorist. The Times adds, as recently as last week, senior Pentagon officials described the group as a vicious entity that had served as a de facto security organization for the Iraqi government. But dozens of members of Congress are supporting the group as a bulwark against Iran. Senior U.S. officials today confirmed that the United States has moved its Air Command Center from Saudi Arabia to Qatar. Rear Admiral David Nichols also told reporters that U.S. air operations at Prince Sultan Air Base will be shut down completely by the end of the summer. Osama bin Laden has cited the U.S. military's large presence in Saudi Arabia as one of his main reasons for waging jihad against the United States. Saudi Arabia is home to the two holiest sites in Islam, Mecca and Medina. Now, according to the New York Times, the U.S. will maintain four military bases in Iraq, home to the cities of Najaf and Karbala, which are sacred to Shia Muslims. Meanwhile, the top U.S. military in Europe outlined plans yesterday for establishing an array of skeletal bases and training areas in Eastern Europe, this according to the Washington Post. Marine General James Jones said the new arrangement would allow the U.S. to reduce its military presence in Western Europe, but still be capable of mounting operations quickly in the region. This as the Bush administration is developing an increasingly strained relationship with key European allies, including Germany and France. British Prime Minister Tony Blair has warned France and other critics of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq not to start a new Cold War with the United States. He said any attempt to create, quote, rival centers of power to compete with the U.S. would restore the disastrous divisions of the Cold War era. However, the leaders of France, Germany, Belgium, and Luxembourg concluded a mini-summit in Brussels today with a call for the establishment of a European Defense Command headquarters. The headquarters would coordinate a 60,000-strong European Union rapid reaction force, which the EU is planning to have up and running by May. The four leaders, who all oppose the U.S. invasion of Iraq, said their proposals would represent a new stage in the building of a common European defense policy. Tony Blair also told anti-war critics not to, quote, gloat or jump around gleefully because coalition forces have so far failed to unearth the weapons of mass destruction which were meant to justify the invasion. He said he remains confident the weapons will be found. Meanwhile, it's now believed more than a dozen 55-gallon drums found in northern Iraq might contain rocket fuel, not the dangerous chemicals first suspected after 2 days of tests. For days, the U.S. corporate media has speculated whether the drums will prove to be the smoking gun. Lieutenant Colonel Ted Martin had told Judith Miller of the New York Times that one of the drums had tested positive for a nerve agent. But an interview later, a U.S. weapons inspector told The Times there the weapons showed no positive results after all. The U.S. Central Command said today Iraq's former oil minister has surrendered. He's Amr Mohammed Rashid. He turned himself in Monday and is in U.S. custody. Rashid is a former Iraqi army general known as the Missile Man by U.S. troops. Before becoming the oil minister, he was Saddam Hussein's point man on weapons delivery systems. He was also a member of the Military Industrialization Organization, the group responsible for producing all of Iraq's most lethal weapons, says the Pentagon. Rashid was listed as number 47 on the coalition's list of the 55 most wanted officials. North Korea has offered to abandon its nuclear weapons program, stop missile exports, and readmit foreign inspectors in return for a U.S. pledge not to attack. The offer was announced last night by the Chinese Foreign Ministry. Secretary of State General Colin Powell says he's examining the proposals. Meanwhile, a conference on nuclear nonproliferation opened in Geneva yesterday. U.S. Assistant Secretary of the Bureau of Nonproliferation John Wolf immediately told a news conference that Iran has, quote, an alarming clandestine program to acquire nuclear technology. But disarmament experts said U.S. lack of commitment to nonproliferation is as damaging as the behavior of the proliferators. Here in the United States, prosecutors have announced a $1.4 billion settlement with the nation's largest investment firms. At firm after firm, brokers and analysts convinced investors to buy billions of dollars worth of stock in companies they knew were going to do badly. Some investment houses received secret payments from companies when they gave a strong recommendation to buy stock in that company. The Securities and Exchange Commission accused three firms in particular of fraud: Citigroup's Salomon Smith Barney, Merrill Lynch, and Credit Suisse First Boston. The settlement bars Citigroup's CEO, Sanford Weill, from even communicating with his firm's stock analysts without a lawyer present. Citigroup is Wall Street's biggest bank. Salomon Smith Barney and First Boston were accused of spinning. That's selling terrific stock offerings to senior executives who turned around and sold the shares for a guaranteed profit. Meanwhile, the New York Times reports many of Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge's former staff members now lobby Ridge on behalf of corporate clients that want contracts with his multi-billion dollar agency. Lobbying disclosure forms filed in Congress show that at least four of Ridge's senior deputies at the White House are now working as Homeland Security lobbyists. Federal regulators have rejected the first complaint under a new campaign finance law that bars soft money contributions to candidates. The complaint said both parties set up organizations to continue collecting soft money despite the ban. The government's negotiating a possible settlement with soap maker Dial Corporation in the largest class action lawsuit for sexual harassment ever. The suit charges that 90 employees at Dial's Aurora plant west of Chicago were groped, called names, and forced to look at pornography. Leaders from Southeast Asia, including China's premier, are set to meet for an emergency SARS summit in Bangkok today. Mongolia, South Korea, and New Zealand have joined the list of countries where people have been infected with SARS. World Health Organization believes Vietnam has effectively contained the virus, but fears the crisis is only getting worse in China. China has announced 9 new deaths and over 200 new cases. Meanwhile, thousands of villagers in the rural town of Chagugang attacked and ransacked a vacant high school that residents believed was being set up to quarantine SARS patients. The local government denied that's what was being done, but villagers saw construction crews installing metal partitions and beds in the building. And today is Israel's annual remembrance for the 6 million Jews killed in the Holocaust. A memorial siren brought Israel to a standstill for 2 minutes. The central theme of the observances focuses on the 60th anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, when groups of Jews armed with smuggled weapons and makeshift explosives attacked Nazi occupation forces and stormtroopers. The German forces responded by cutting off the starved ghetto's water supply and burning its crowded buildings to the ground. Meanwhile, Palestinian security sources say Israeli helicopter and tank raids have killed 3 Palestinian militants in the Gaza Strip In another incident, four farmers were injured when Israeli troops guarding a nearby Jewish settlement block opened fire. Israel's Supreme Court has thrown out an attempt by human rights groups to bar the army's use of flechette shells against Palestinians. The weapons explode in the air and spread thousands of small metal darts over a wide area. Tel Aviv's Physicians for Human Rights and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights had argued that use of the shells in residential areas is against international law. And Israel's ambassador to the United States called for regime change in Iraq, in Iran, and Syria. Daniel Ayalon said toppling Saddam Hussein's government is not enough. He did not call for an invasion of Syria and Iran, but advocated isolating them diplomatically, imposing economic sanctions, and using, quote, psychological pressure. This comes as it has emerged that U.S. Congressmember Tom Lantos met privately with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and passed a message from Syrian President Bashar Assad. Assad said he's interested in diplomatic contacts with Israel to resolve their differences. But the Israeli newspaper Haaretz today cited unnamed Israeli officials as saying that the Assad overture was a trick aimed at deflecting U.S. pressure on Damascus. Never expect power always, Fellas drummer Tony Allen. Here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. This news in from Nigeria, Africa's most populous country and the fifth largest supplier of oil to the United States. Nearly 100 foreign oil workers, including 21 people from the United States and 35 from Britain, were being held hostage by striking Nigerian workers aboard offshore installations. This according to a report just out from the Associated Press. The strikers have been holding 97 foreign counterparts aboard four offshore drilling rigs owned by the Houston-based Transocean since April 19th. The action in a remote area of Nigeria's coastline became known only recently. The rigs were drilling wells on behalf of oil multinationals Royal Dutch Shell and Total Fina Elf. In other news from Nigeria, it's been 10 days since voters went to the polls, but the results are still in dispute. The sitting Nigerian president, Olusegun Obasanjo, has claimed victory, but international election monitors report widespread voting fraud. Nigeria's main opposition parties had called on the international community not to recognize the election results. Obasanjo's main challenger, Muhammadu Buhari, vowed to challenge the results. Buhari is head of the All Nigeria People's Party. The opposition parties have also rejected the April 12th legislative election results, citing vote rigging on behalf of Obasanjo's party. We're joined right now by Shroya Moile. He is a Nigerian student leader and also a graduate student at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Shroya.
Thank you. Good morning, Amy.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Can you talk about the elections, Obasanjo, and his relationship with the United States?
Well, Obasanjo used to be a military president between 1976 and 79, and the only reason why he's regarded as a credible person was that he handed over power in 1979 in a carefully organized election in which Shehu Shagari was given power, almost practically by Obasanjo, because they wanted a federal center that is weak enough to allow the military to take over as soon as possible. And that was possible in 1983 when Buhari, who is his challenger in this election, took over from Shagari. So he was made into an international statesman by Jimmy Carter, who's been holding Jimmy Carter's coattail, going around the world and preaching democracy. Why he himself does not believe in democracy. On June 12, 1993, elections that were the most free and fair was held in Nigeria. And Obasanjo was one of the characters who frustrated Moshood Abiola from coming to power by going behind closed doors with Babangida and also Buhari to make sure that that election did not come to fruition.
And Moshood Abiola was the democratically elected president of Nigeria,
yes,
but held in prison for many years
and
until
he died.
He died
in prison. And while he was in prison, Obasanjo was also arrested because he lost out in power play with Abacha. And he was
the military dictator,
yes,
Abacha.
Abacha. And he was brought back from prison to become president after they had successfully taken care of Abiola. It was believed that he poisoned Abiola and he died.
In fact, didn't he die almost in William Pickering's lap?
Well, he did, actually. It's not almost, but he died. They have still not told anybody in Nigeria where the tea came from that he drank.
He was brought out of prison to meet with the U.S. representative.
Exactly, led by Pickering and Susan Rice, yes.
Who was head of the Africa Division in the State Department. They gave him tea.
He drank and
died.
Collapsed and died. Yes.
When Obasanjo was last elected, he came to the United States. I got a chance to see him in New York. He was being shepherded around by the overseas president of Chevron Corporation.
Yes. His visit to the U.S. then was sponsored entirely by Chevron. He came on a private jet rented, you know, by Chevron.
Can you talk about this election and what happened as you were getting word from home over the last 2 weeks?
Well, I made it very clear that from almost 2 years ago that this election was decided. What has happened is that Obasanjo and his cronies all over Nigeria decided that they were going to rig the election, and they perfected how to rig the election by doing it in three ways. There was a pre-election rigging in which they had this massive voter registration with fictitious names, and where they couldn't get fictitious names, they purchased these registration cards from people. And they had the election day rigging, in which in places where they didn't vote and in several parts of the country, they used the army and the police to stuff ballot boxes. And they also had the, after the post-election rigging, in which at the collation centers, they manipulated the figures of the election and make sure that Obasanjo won. In places in the Niger Delta, for example, where about 2 weeks before the election, they had invaded, you know, with full soldiers and Navy presence, actually using two U.S.-donated Navy ships that are now christened in another name. They had 100% of election results in places like River State in Niger Delta, also in Warri in the Niger Delta, where no voting took place because of military repression. They had 100% results. Only in Iraq, or maybe in Florida 2000, would you find those kind of results in any election. So these elections were massively flawed. As a matter of fact, the elections were adjudged to be worse than those of Zimbabwe. And when Zimbabwe had a similar election, they called for the expulsion of Zimbabwe from the Commonwealth and also from being isolated from the rest of the world. Whereas in Nigeria, they are saying that even these elections were not free and fair, they were credible. That was what the State Department said. And that is so funny. So I'm saying generally that this must be a copy and paste election from Florida 2000.
What about this latest hostage taking, the latest protests by Nigerians in the Niger Delta? And this follows on a series of them that were led by women.
Yes. I think the women coming out in Niger Delta was to debunk the attempt by the State Department and the Nigerian government to term the agitation in Niger Delta as a terrorist act. As a matter of fact, the Niger Delta agitation was going in the direction of being regarded by the FBI as terrorism. So the women came out massively without arms to take over Chevron platform and to press for demands that had been on since a long time ago and that led to the death of Ken Saro-Wiwa, for example, and the massive repression that Abacha took, and also that Obasanjo continued in Odi. What is happening is that the Niger Delta issue did not and has never been resolved by the Nigerian government, and they have always gotten the support of the U.S. and oil companies around the world and countries around the world that have companies that are drilling oil in Nigeria to suppress the people in Niger Delta. Since 1999, for example, the U.S. has been training the Nigerian military to be very brutal and how to curtail the agitation in Niger Delta. So it is a failure to talk about these issues that have led to more of the agitation that you are seeing. It's been undertaken by women, men, and it's been undertaken by communities, Christians and Muslims in Niger Delta. It has nothing to do with terrorism. It's about redressing the injustice, massive injustice that has been carried out by oil corporations, the Nigerian government, and countries who are their partners doing business of oil in Nigeria.
When I said that Nigeria is the fifth largest supplier of oil to the United States, you said it's actually gone up from there.
Yes, it has, due to the war in Iraq and the reduction of consumption of oil from the Middle East. For 2 weeks, in about 2 months ago, the U.S. Nigeria was the second largest importer of oil to the U.S. aside from Saudi Arabia. Because Venezuela, also, that is a country that used to be one of the greatest suppliers, wasn't also cooperating with us. They had the country almost shut down due to connivance between the U.S. government and the so-called opposition in Venezuela.
Well, Shori Mole, I want to thank you very much for being with us, and it's very good to see you again. Shori and I traveled together through the Niger Delta, along with Democracy Now! Producer Jeremy Scahill in 1998, to his homeland, to Elijah Land in the Niger Delta, where Chevron Corporation was involved with the killing of two Nigerian villagers who were protesting. Our documentary, Drilling and Killing, Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship, you can listen to online at democracynow.org. Thank you again, Shori Moile. Shori is a student now at Columbia University, a graduate student, and was a student leader who was tortured under Abacha in Nigeria. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to turn now to a very interesting cross-border issue. Canadian immigration officials are attempting again to deport Charlie Wolf Smoke to the United States. Smoke claims he's an Aboriginal Indian and that his ancestors were in North America long before the white settlers. He says he can float freely across the border without proof of citizenship. These are his words. My Americanized name is Charlie Smoke. My ancestry is Lakota and Mohawk. I'm neither American nor Canadian. I'm an Aboriginal member of Turtle Island, both pre-American and pre-Canadian, an Indigenous person from the Western Hemisphere, a native North American, a member of the Red Race, a Lakota national. Ambiguity surrounds Smoke's citizenship because his birth was never registered and he was never registered as a status Indian. He says he was born in his family's house on the Akwesasne Reserve, which straddles the borders of Quebec, Ontario, and New York State. Smoke was escorted to the U.S. border in January of last year, but was refused entrance when U.S. officials said there was not sufficient paperwork to prove that he is a U.S. citizen. After months of digging, Canadian immigration officials say they can prove that Smoke is a U.S. citizen. They say there's a birth certificate and fingerprints showing he's really a man named Roger Adams, a lost boy from Memphis, Tennessee. Well, we go now to Charlie Wolf Smoke, where he is scheduled to be deported in a couple of hours. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Where are you?
I'm at my kitchen table in Regina, Saskatchewan.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't you tell us your story in your own words?
Okay. Let's see. I'll have to wrap up quite a bit in about 1 minute, but basically, I was working at an inner-city high school here in Regina, Scott Collegiate, with almost a total Indian student population. I was hired to work in student support services, but due to my science background, I ended up co-teaching grade 9 science. At the end of the school year, the principal asked me to bring more Native content into the school. And I did this. There were social, cultural, political, historical things that I brought in. Some of the political things that I brought in upset someone and led to CIC, or Citizenship and Immigration Canada, coming to the school the day before the last day of school to order me to quit my job. I refused. They ordered the principal fire me. The principal refused. Then the board office was contacted, and then they told the principal that she had to let me go. So I finished off the rest of the school year, which was a day and a third, as a volunteer, just so I could wrap up what I was doing so as not to upset the students. From the very beginning, this entire situation was clearly political. If you look at my Indigenous Awakening website, you can find evidence to explain that. Also, almost from the beginning, they were creating people and fabricating documentation against me. One of the first creations was the name of a supposed informant by the name of Walita Soto. There's a reserve close to here where I have a lot of friends who live there, carried a cattle reserve. That's where the Soto family came from. I asked different people who this person was, and no one's ever heard of her. She doesn't exist. They came up with the name Charles Hornchips, and they tried to convince everyone that that person was me. This Roger Leo Adams now is the third name that they have come up with. And then to jump back to January 2002, they tried to deport me at that time. They said, they showed the Americans a piece of paper they photocopied from the Immigration Act, and they put blanks in the top where they typed in my name, my date of birth, USA, and the agent that was there signed it at the bottom. This was supposed to be concrete proof that I was born in the United States. When I took issue of that, and I pointed out to the American official that the guy who handed it to him signed it, he threw his hands up and said, well, I'm not getting involved in whatever's going on between you and Canada Immigration. So they had no choice but to bring me back. They tried to shuffle me around from one jail to another jail to lose me. They put me in maximum security, 24-hour lockdown, ordered me to have no contact. But because it was local, all the jailers were very aware of the situation, and they made it possible for me to get word out to my wife, who notified the media that I had been moved and where I was. Then there was a rally on my behalf the following day, and a federal adjudicator was forced to release me. And there have been other fabrications by Canada against me in the process. Now, with this latest one, because they're very concerned with the way that they have been portrayed by the media, especially in Canada, more than once in this April 22nd hearing, they said, we have been much maligned by the media because of you, but this time they're going to believe us. And they claimed to have found a long-lost brother who identified me as being his brother, this Roger Leo Adams. We tried to get information. They also claimed to have fingerprints. We asked to see the evidence. We didn't see anything. And after a local radio station tracked down two members of this family and attempted an interview with them, they let me know how they located these people. I went on the internet. I found their phone numbers the same way that the CBC radio did, and phoned both of them. The woman was really upset. Before I heard these attempted interviews, I thought that these people had been made up. After talking to them, now I can see that that this family and this individual does exist, and they're using that individual, even at the expense of the emotions of this family, to get rid of me and to relieve the pressure that Canada has been under these past 2 years. And I asked this alleged brother why he told Canada Immigration that I was his relative, and he denied ever saying that. So I asked him to make a statement and fax it to me and to local media here in Regina, which he did. After he almost immediately after he did that, suddenly immigration came up with another alleged relative in another state who went on the air saying, you know, the same thing, that I was this person. But in that interview, which was on CBC television last night, this woman also said that they had previously, a year ago, 10 years ago, but at some point they had hired a private investigator to find their relative, and that he presented them with evidence that this Roger Leo Adams was dead. Now suddenly Canada Immigration has apparently convinced some members of this family that this Roger Leo Adams has risen from the grave and taken on a new identity, and it's me. And it's just an easy way for Canada to escape the pressure that they have been under. And then also there is, in Canada, just like the United States, there is a lot of movement to tighten up the border, to take on more of a Big Brother-type personality, and to deny everyone any sense of rights or individuality. There's a new immigration bill that the Minister of Immigration, Denis Coderre, is trying to push through right now. And I am the major obstacle in the way of this new Canadian immigration bill. In fact, on my e-list, I have an excerpt from discussions that were made at Parliament Hill, where local federal MP Dick Proctor was on the floor of the Parliament Hill, or whatever they call it, arguing against the new immigration bill. And it was my situation and that of an Algerian family that he used to state that, as it is, the current immigration bill has serious flaws in it, and that increasing these flaws and making it worse is not in anyone's best interest other than the government. Mm-hmm. And I've wasted a whole week disproving what was said, because it's kind of a cheap shot to take on any Indian who has light hair or maybe has light skin or whatever to say, well, you look like a half-breed or you look like a white man. When you're kids or when you're teenagers, people say that to be hateful. But even as childish and vindictive as Canada Immigration has been, I didn't expect that type of attack from them. So it was like getting hit below the belt.
And can you tell me, Charlie Wilsmoke, why the U.S. is going to accept you now when they denied you entry in January?
I have no idea what was said in discussions. In the April 22nd hearing, I asked them, when no media was present, if they had already made arrangements with the American officials, and they said that they had. It was discussed. It was a done deal.
Will they hold you in detention in the United States, or will you be...
It's likely that they're going to do that. Right after this April 22nd hearing, I got a phone call, and someone told me about the statement that John Ashcroft had just made, where in part he said that anyone entering the United States with unsatisfactory documents would be detained indefinitely. And the fact that they... there's so much dispute over this right now. Obviously, I fit into the category of unsatisfactory documents. And then on top of that, there are other issues. For instance, the last name that they tagged on me, the man was wanted by the FBI. Now, this person, they claim that he doesn't have a criminal record, but they have lied to me before. And on top of that, as I just stated, evidence was given to this family before that this individual was dead. Now, I would think that before any competent investigator tells a family that one of their relatives is dead, there must be a body, or at least a reasonable belief that there's a corpse somewhere. So now, if they try to say that I'm this person, then they're going to have to question, well, then, why did we think you were dead? Who is this dead person?
So what is going to happen right now? And is that your child in the background?
That's my youngest.
How many kids do you have?
Six.
And what will happen with them?
Well, the children want to return to South Dakota to be able to escape all this, because they have been harassed by authorities, by the police up here also. But with a family of eight, I mean, it takes a certain amount of time and planning and money to move somewhere, and you have to have a place to move to.
So what will happen in the next few hours?
It's really difficult to say. There's, on the one hand, we acquired a federal attorney who attempted to get an injunction in court yesterday to stop it based on a legal precedent which Canada Immigration continues to ignore. That's of a custom adoption overriding a deportation order. The judge refused to look at it until this morning, which I find to be really extremely fishy. But at the same time, we were also in discussions with an international lawyer who sent documents to the Human Rights Committee in Geneva, Switzerland, yesterday afternoon, which would have been the middle of the night in Geneva.
Do you expect to be deported in the next few hours?
It's likely. I think it's more likely that I'm going to be detained, and it could be on either side of the border.
If people want to get more information on your case, where should they go on the web?
Go to my website. If you do a Yahoo or Google search for Charlie Smoke, my Indigenous Awakening website on Tripod will come up, and there's extensive information, including several news pieces going back to the first time it appeared in the media almost 2 years ago.
Well, it's very interesting to talk to you, especially at a time when so many populations in the United States feel under siege as people try to stay and they're being deported, for you to be forcibly deported into the United States. Thank you for being with us, and we will continue to follow your case. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Our world has begun to spin like a Ferris wheel. The threat of world annihilation is getting very real. And what of hope and happiness? Are they forever lost? Or will just step in and prevent another Holocaust? Oh, everybody better wake up. Everybody better wake up. The superpowers better wake up. The world powers better wake up.
Wake up. The Neville Brothers here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Operation End Extremism. This is the name of a campaign started by the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee to combat what it sees as a new threat to the U.S. military, environmental regulators. Last month, the Pentagon asked Congress to, quote, clarify environmental regulations. The Pentagon's basic complaint is that laws governing air pollution, toxic waste dumps, endangered species, and even marine mammals interfere with training and readiness exercises necessary for national security. Employing an unusual tactic for a Senate committee, periodic emails are sent to journalists offering sentence-by-sentence rebuttals of environmental groups' criticisms of the Pentagon's request. Meanwhile, the Bush administration has imposed a gag order on the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency from publicly discussing perchlorate pollution. This comes as two new studies reveal high levels of the rocket fuel component, which the Pentagon uses, that may be contaminating the nation's lettuce supply. The studies, commissioned by the Environmental Working Group, found perchlorate in samples of lettuce traced to growers in Southern California and Arizona. High-level exposure of perchlorate in young children can produce deficits in brain function and motor skills. Well, we're going to start off with Operation End Extremism. We are joined by Dmitry Sevastopoulou of the Financial Times. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks very much.
Well, can you talk about what this operation is and why the Senate or a Senate committee has launched it?
Well, first you need to go back to look at the leadership of the Senate committee. It's headed by Senator James Inhofe from Oklahoma, who a number of years ago described the Environmental Protection Agency as a Gestapo agency. He's considered to be one of the most anti-environmental senators in the House of Congress. And his staff have decided that the environmental groups are very good at getting their message out. They have good lobbying organizations in Washington. They have substantial resources behind them. And in an attempt to rebut some of the claims that they make, the committee decided to send out almost a daily email to journalists, rebutting line by line some of the arguments the environmental groups are making.
Now, how'd they come up with the name Operation End Extremism?
Well, the extremism is their perception of the environmental community, and the Operation End Extremism, I think, is timed very nicely to fit in with what is going on in the Middle East and the war on terrorism globally.
Can you talk about some of the points that they are rebutting line by line?
Well, the main point of contention is the Pentagon, which originally submitted the request to Congress last month and then this month submitted another request in a slightly different form, has said that what it is doing is trying to clarify environmental rules. The environmental community says that it's not trying to clarify. What it's trying to do is to seek exemptions to rules. For example, on a military training base, they're trying to change the definition of solid waste so that ammunition and munitions would not be included. If they're not included in the definition, that means the Pentagon is not required to clean them up. So what you have is the environmental producing one claim, and then the Operation End Extremism will go through and say that this is not an attempt to change anything. This is just looking for a clarification of the existing law. And what's really going on here is that the military under Donald Rumsfeld are trying to ensure that they won't be bogged down by a series of lawsuits in the future. And one of the interesting things has been that in February, the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, Christy Todd Whitman, said that she saw no reason or no place where environmental regulations were hampering the military's efforts to train. Yet the following month, when she was questioned on this again, she appeared to do a U-turn and said that actually she was very comfortable with the language that the Pentagon was sending to Congress.
I want to bring Bill Walker into this conversation, Vice President for the West Coast Office of the Environmental Working Group. Can you talk about the connection between a chemical that you're investigating and, is it the Pentagon? Bill Walker?
Hi, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. The chemical is perchlorate, as you mentioned at the beginning, and it's basically toxic rocket fuel. In chemical that's in solid rocket fuel and has been used for decades now in both the military and the space shuttle. We call perchlorate the toxic legacy of the Cold War, and this latest controversy over cleanup of military bases is just another way in which that legacy is being carried out. All over the country, at both military bases and at defense contractor sites operated by giants like Lockheed Martin, perchlorate is leaking into the groundwater, and it's been contaminating water supplies, hundreds of water supplies in more than 20 states. We've known that for some time. What has arisen over the last year is a concern that perchlorate getting into irrigation water in Southern California and Arizona is also being taken up by the crops grown in that area, specifically lettuce, which is a very water-intensive crop. We know that the lower Colorado River near the Mexican border is contaminated with perchlorate, and we know that that area produces more than three-quarters of the lettuce that's sold in the United States during the winter months only, October to March. So what this means, if our findings in the survey that we did of supermarket lettuce are confirmed, is that perchlorate moves from being a localized or regionalized problem in areas where the water is contaminated to a national concern for anybody who buys winter lettuce at the grocery store.
Can you talk about the gag order imposed by the Environmental Protection Agency?
completely by surprise. We've been working closely with various EPA officials, not on a formal level, but certainly on an informal level while we've been doing our research. They've seen drafts of it. They've told us that we were on the right track. They've confirmed everything that we're looking at as being generally in the same area that they're looking at. And then so it was quite a surprise when we got ready to release our report last week to find out from journalists that the EPA had suddenly been ordered not to discuss it at all. And I think that, the ostensible reason given was that this matter is undergoing another scientific review by the National Academy of Sciences, and they didn't want to comment until they got those results back. But I think very clearly that there's a very clear connection to the military exemption hearings and not wanting to make this issue of perchlorate contamination more controversial or more of a lightning rod than it's already become.
Do you find doing environmental work and activism harder now, post 9/11?
Oh, I think certainly post 9/11, and also in the post Iraq, if we can be said to be in the post Iraq era yet. There's been a real reluctance to criticize anything, any operations of the military, for fear of being labeled disloyal or a traitor or whatever. For example, during the month of that the Iraq war was really at its hottest, we had this study on perchlorate contamination and let us ready to go, but we didn't release it simply because there was no news hole available for it for the time. The war news was driving everything else off of not just the front pages, but the entire news sections. So certainly you have to be a little bit more careful about what you say, and there's less opportunity to say it. Fortunately, this climate hasn't stopped some elected officials from going ahead and being responsive to their duty, and I particularly want to single out Senators Boxer and Feinstein, who've really pressed the Pentagon on this issue, writing letters, demanding answers. When are you going to stop dragging your feet? When are you going to clean this mess up? Aren't you really trying to get out of cleaning this mess up with these exemptions? The Pentagon hasn't been very responsive, but they've been very persistent in raising the issue.
So what do you recommend, whether people should eat lettuce or not?
Well, the first thing to recognize is that the lettuce that's on the shelves right now is not coming from the area that we tested and the area that we know there's perchlorate contamination. It comes from a different part of California where we know there is not perchlorate contamination. But certainly the population that's of greatest concern for perchlorate exposure is women who are pregnant or who are considering getting pregnant, because perchlorate, the chemical, as you pointed out, attacks the thyroid gland, and that can very severely affect the developing fetus or infant's ability to develop motor skills, their IQ, and so forth. So while we don't have enough information to make a definitive recommendation, we are certainly saying that come next October, when the lettuce in the stores will again be coming from this region of California, that women who are pregnant or who are considering getting pregnant should be very cautious about the amount of lettuce that they buy unless they know that it's coming from an area where the water is not contaminated with perchlorate. That's our recommendation for the consumers. Beyond that, we're urging that the federal government, the Food and Drug Administration, do an immediate emergency study of the possibility of perchlorate contamination of the nation's food supply. We certainly don't have the resources to conduct that survey on the scale that needs to be done, but the Pentagon, in conjunction with the perchlorate polluters who are responsible for this mess, certainly does. And in that regard, I'd just point out one more thing interesting that your previous guest was talking about, Senator Inhofe. He, of course, represents the state of Oklahoma, which is the headquarters for the Kerr-McGee Corporation, which is a defense contractor that is largely responsible for the perchlorate pollution that is in the Colorado River contaminating this lettuce.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. We've been joined by Bill Walker, a vice president for the West Coast Office of the Environmental Working Group, and Dimitri Sevastopoulou of the Financial Times on Operation End extremism. On May 1st, the people of Yekes are planning a large party, a four-day round-the-clock fiesta of fireworks and salsa music to celebrate a landmark event, the official end of Yekes' existence as a target range for the U.S. military. It's a milestone in Puerto Rican history. The Navy's presence on Yekes dates back to the 1940s, and an opportunity for residents to celebrate because they blame the range for crippling the economy, spoiling the fish stock, and making children sick. Residents who once threw themselves in the line of fire as Vieques waged a campaign to oust the Navy will be feted as guests of honor, and we'll be bringing you reports live from Vieques. But for right now, we're going to your comments. Listeners and viewers around the country who have been calling Democracy Now! As we broadcast now on more than 150 radio and public television stations around the United States and the largest public media collaboration in this country, also broadcasting on Free Speech TV, Channel 9415, Dish Network, and Radio for Peace International, which is shortwave radio based in Costa Rica, and live video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. If you want to see any of the expanded two-hour programs we do daily, the War and Peace Report, you can just go to our website at any time and watch them. We are going to turn now to the comments of people like you.
Hi, you've reached Democracy Now! Please leave your name, where you're calling from, the station you listen to, and what you're doing in this time of war. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Dale Fink calling from Berkshire County, Massachusetts. I listen to you on WRPI out of Troy, New York. Colin Powell, G.W. Bush, Richard Pearl, and others keep telling us that the Iraqi oil, the oil under their land, belongs to the Iraqi people. If that's the case, I think a lot of us Americans would like to get a piece of the Alaskan oil, the Texan oil, and other oil that they have never told us belongs to us, the American people, nor did they ever say it would be used, the proceeds of it would be used solely for our benefit. I would like to know about this socialist plan they have for Iraq to declare that the people of Iraq are able to own and control their own resources, and I would wonder why they don't import that idea back here to the States.
Hi, I'm Sue Hammond from Syracuse. I listen to you on FSTV, Dish Network. I was pretty quiet during the Vietnam War, and I told myself I wouldn't make that mistake again. Depleted uranium may in the end prove to be the most potent weapon of mass destruction used in this war. It will not only affect the Iraqis, but our own troops in time to come, and perhaps even their children, as DU has been found in the semen of troops from past conflicts where it was used. In fact, DU may well qualify, like mustard gas or cyanide, as an illegal weapon of war. I think it's very important for those who think they must support the war in order to support the troops to know that the biggest danger to the troops may not be from the weapons the enemy is using, but from the ones we are using.
And if you'd like to comment during this time, you can give us a call at 212-209-2999. You can also email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. You can go to our website and www.democracynow.org. And you can get a copy of today's program by calling 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Quddus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Reibel and Vilka Tsouris. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Special thanks to Angela Alston, Emily Kunstler, Orlando Richards, Simba Russo, Rafael De La Uz, Gabriel Weiss, Johnny Sender, Rich Kim, Karen Renucci, Fatima Mujadidi, Dennis Moynihan, Jenny Felipazzo. And congratulations to Emily Kunstler for her Whitney Fellowship. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.